the national anthem of Canada. Oh, Canada. Introducing us here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Herod, a weekly blog talk radio show where we like to look at important events of the day for conservatives and others. And today we want to look to the true north, to Canada, to analyze a recent horrific incident, four individuals from an entire family, a man and his wife and their daughter, as well as the man's mother, the grandmother and the family, four members of a Pakistani-Canadian Muslim family in London, Ontario, as well as a fifth member of the family, a nine-year-old boy, was left wounded in the attack by one young 20-year-old Canadian man, Nathaniel Veltman. And we want to discuss this issue in the context of rising cries of Islamophobia and what that will mean for, say, cracking down on any speech about Islam with Robert Spencer, the director of Jihad Watch, an important, invaluable resource online for anything and all things concerning jihad around the world, where I am also a contributor. So welcome to the show, Robert Spencer.
Always good to talk to you, Andrew. How are you?
Oh, excellent. Well, good to have you. Always good to listen to you. Well, we had this last Sunday, June 6, 2021, in London, Ontario. Nathaniel Veltman, a 20-year-old man, drove his pickup truck onto the sidewalk and ran over a Pakistani-Canadian Muslim family taking an evening walk, killing thereby four individuals, the man, husband and wife, and their daughter, as well as the daughter's grandmother, and seriously wounding then the daughter's nine-year-old brother, who is now in hospital, has been left an orphan by this attack. Now, there's been some indication this Nathaniel Veltman was really sort of a loner, showed a lot of anger, had sort of mental problems. But many commentators and political leaders like Justin Trudeau, Canada's prime minister, have been saying that this was an anti-Muslim hate attack. Do you know, have any idea or speculation or any information as to who this person was and what might have motivated this attack?
Well, you know, Andrew, there's very little information available out there about him, and that's strange. For a 20-year-old man, he doesn't have any social media presence. That's quite unusual, but he doesn't. And so what we know about him comes from his parents and from people who knew him earlier in his life. And we know that he's 20 years old, as I said, that he comes from a Christian family. He was homeschooled until high school, and his family and he were at odds. He was described as combative and argumentative. He ultimately had a rupture with his family to the extent that he was legally – he sought and obtained legal emancipation from his family about 4 years ago when he was 16. And that's about all that we know, essentially. And so one of the things that's glaringly absent from that capsule description and these little bits of details is any indication that he had some kind of particular hatred for Muslims in general. Now, I'm not saying that he didn't, but it's very odd. The Canadian government came out right away after his attack and said that this was an Islamophobic attack and they're going to crack down on the so-called far right and Islamophobia. But one thing that nobody has produced, neither the Canadian government nor the police nor anybody else, is any actual evidence that this was what they say it was, an Islamophobic attack.
Yeah, I guess it would be just sort of circumstantial. Maybe, you know, they'd say, you know, the family walking by was sort of obviously maybe an appearance to Islamic, and they were saying it's sort of pre-planned that and he just drove over them. He drove to a parking lot of a shopping mall nearby and then stopped and apparently just sort of gave himself up and admitted, say, hey, you know, I killed these people. He was wearing like a body armor vest and a helmet, some sort of helmet. And some people said that he had some swastikas on his shirt or something. He apparently had a Facebook page, but Facebook took it down. As you're indicating, you know, there's sort of like it was an automatic response from the Canadian government that they just said that this is a hate attack, you know, sort of off the cuff. I mean, you wonder, where did they get that? Is that common that a government comes out and says automatically, say, yeah, we think this is a hate attack, and we're not going to wait for further information?
Well, that's another curious thing about this, Andrew. I mean, it may be. I never heard about the swastikas until you just mentioned it. And so it may be that they're basing it on that, or maybe he said something. Maybe he acknowledged that that's what he was doing. I don't know. I don't think anybody knows right now except those who were actually arresting him on the scene. But the thing is that governments are generally far more circumspect and cautious in this kind of situation, and particularly when it comes to jihad terror attacks. Governments in Europe, as well as the government of Canada and the government of the United States, in numerous cases, have been extremely wary about talking about Islamic jihad terrorism, and sometimes outright denying it to the point of absurdity, so that you have, for example, the notorious instance in 2009 when an army major in the U.S., Nidal Malik Hassan, was screaming Allahu Akbar, people at Fort Hood in Texas, and he was later discovered to be in communication with the jihad mastermind Anwar al-Awlaki, and there were numerous other indications that he had given in his professional work that he was a jihadi himself and was potentially violent. He had alarmed his coworkers before the attack with his intimations that he might one day commit an act of violence. And yet the Obama administration, in its official report, classified it as workplace violence and not as terrorism. And that is one example, unfortunately, among quite a few, where a rather obvious case of Islamic jihad terrorism is dismissed as a manifestation of mental illness or a manifestation of something else altogether. And so it's kind of striking that in this case, the government seemed to know all about what the motivations of the attack were, even far before it was even possible for them to have completed a full investigation.
Yeah, I mean, the key question here is, was this person sort of mentally unstable? I mean, many people have described him as being really sort of mentally unstable, being combative, as you said, and he was noted for, like, playing loud music in his apartment dwelling in a building and irritating his neighbors that way, but then also being very much of a loner. So there's still a lot of questions about who this individual was. Well, we of course have the infamous 2009 case of the workplace violence of Nidal Hassan at Fort Hood, Texas. But have there been other cases of supposed anti-Muslim hate crimes that have revealed themselves as something else?
Oh, there have been cases of anti-Muslim hate crimes that have turned out not to be? No, I don't know any cases like that. None at all. I've never seen it. I've been following jihad activity around the world every day for the last 20 years, and I've never seen a case where people say, oh, this is jihad terrorism, and then it turns out not to be. But I've seen innumerable cases of the opposite, where it is very clearly jihad terrorism, and authorities insist that it isn't. As a matter of fact, I've written two articles, and I could write 10 more. The first one was called The Global Outbreak of Mental Illness, and it was just a long list of instances where it was very clear that the attacker was a jihadi. He was screaming Allahu Akbar, or he was waving a Quran around, or he was even explaining his actions on the basis of the Quran and Islam, and his attack was not classified as terrorism, but as mental illness. And this is just a recurring theme, so frequently recurring as practically to be comical if it weren't that there's so much at stake. And it happens all the time in Europe and the United States that these attacks are dismissed in this way.
Yeah, well, I guess that was the point I was trying to get at. I mean, I guess you and others have written about, like, there's the case of, you know, supposedly, the faked murder of, it was actually an honor killing of a Muslim teenager by the parents, and they faked it to look like a hate crime. But, you know, you bring up an interesting point on the other hand, too, that there's been this long string of trying to sort of declassify or classify away jihadist attacks as being mental illness, which seems to be sort of the exact opposite of what we're dealing here with Nathaniel Feltman, that there seems to be a lot of evidence that he could be mentally disturbed, but here that's sort of being pushed aside, and all of a sudden people are jumping to the conclusion, oh, it's an anti-Muslim hate attack.
Yeah, well, you know, it has to be said in this context that the Canadian government, as well as the American government and others, are committed to the idea that Muslims are indeed victimized in some special way and are the particular victims of harassment and discrimination in the United States and Canada and elsewhere, such that they deserve special accommodation and consideration. And this idea is so thinly based. I mean, you know, we had Joe Biden during his campaign for president last summer assuring Muslim groups that he would fight against anti-Muslim bigotry and Islamophobia, when actually FBI hate crime statistics show that attacks against innocent Muslims are very few. Attacks against Jews, attacks against other groups are far more common than attacks against Muslims. Not even one is justified. But the fact is that it's really not a major problem in the United States. But Biden made it out to be, vowed to combat it. And the thing is that this kind of narrative that Muslims are victims, are being victimized in the U.S., is so common on the left today, it has to be supported. And you don't have enough, when you don't have enough Islamophobic incidents that are genuine, then you have to do things like what we're seeing in this case, or what might be the what's going on in this case, that the authorities in question jump to conclusions and force the incident into the narrative that they need prop up and to support. And thus they're able to point to this and say, see, there is this big problem of violent Islamophobia in Canada and elsewhere. But actually, they have pounded a square peg into a round hole here. It doesn't really fit their narrative, but they don't have anything else that fits it any better, and so they have to use what they have.
Well, you know, speaking of this narrative of Islamophobia, as you've indicated, killing of this murder of four individuals has prompted sort of such cries from the usual suspects, you might say, the National Council of Canadian Muslims, which actually started out as the Council on American Islamic Relations, Canada, CARE, CA, the Canadian affiliate of CARE, this Hamas-derived organization, Muslim Brotherhood organization. They've sent an open letter to Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. And for example, they've talked about that this killing of four individuals in London, Ontario, it mirrors other attacks on Muslims like the I guess it was 2014 or so, North Carolina Chapel Hill killing of three individuals, which actually evidence indicated was from another very sort of disturbed man who had a parking dispute with these three people. It was actually a sort of a leftist atheist, a hater of all religion, a supporter of like the Southern Poverty Law Center, and killed them. But that's mentioned then in this letter to Justin Trudeau, and they're calling now for appointing a special envoy on Islamophobia to go around the world and combat Islamophobia. Well, how have such crimes promoted this Islamophobia narrative and therefore stifled critical inquiry into Islam in Canada or elsewhere?
Well, see, the idea is that any kind of see, this is the thing about Islamophobia, Andrew. Islamophobia is a lazy propaganda word that is designed, I believe intentionally, to mislead people. And what it is it's a conflation of two distinct phenomena that actually have nothing to do with one another, but are forcibly put together by those who use the word. So in the first place, you have attacks on innocent Muslims, like this incident in Canada. And that's called Islamophobia, and everybody's against that. Nobody is in favor of attacks on any innocent people anywhere. And so everybody says, yes, this is terrible. We have to fight this Islamophobia. But the word Islamophobia is also used for any honest examination of the motives and goals of jihad terrorists and how they use the Islamic texts and teachings in order to justify violence and supremacism and oppression of women and others. And so if you call that Islamophobia as well, then it's very easy to use the first meaning of Islamophobia in order to kill the second. That is, you use the idea that Islamophobia means attacks on innocent Muslims in order to stigmatize, demonize, and silence those who are looking at the ideology of Islam and how it inspires violence. And so the idea of Islamophobia and fighting Islam is really very pernicious, that what should be done, it's pernicious because what should be done is people fight against the idea that there should be vigilante attacks on any innocent people, and that's fine. But when you start talking about Islamophobia in this broad and lazy fashion, then it becomes a weapon by which you can silence criticism of Islam, which is in line with the Organization of Islamic Cooperation's years-long effort now to do just that, to force Western countries, including Canada and the United States, into criminalizing criticism of Islam, making blasphemy a criminal offense once again, and specifically outlawing cartoons of Muhammad, mockery of Islam, criticism of Islam. And so that's what this is all about. And it looks as if that's what the Canadian government is doing, that they are rushing to use this incident as a pretext to act against groups that they dislike, including those that criticize Islam.
Yeah, I mean, in this letter from the National Council of Canadian Muslims, NCCM, you know, they're calling for a special envoy on Islamophobia, something which has also been called for by CARE here in the United States. They mentioned removing discriminatory laws in Canada, ensuring that anti-racism and anti-Islamophobia become part of our education system. And they also want the Canadian government to host on an emergency basis a national action summit on Islamophobia, convening leaders from all levels of government in Canada. And then they also, in conjunction with this National Action Summit on Islamophobia, they want Canada to work with leaders of the G7 nations on sharing best practices and resources. So as you mentioned, you know, this sounds like really getting in a de facto blasphemy law through the back door, through this campaign of against Islamophobia that has been pushed by the Islamic Organization, by the Organization of Islamic Cooperation for decades now. I mean, should not such Muslim victims here of this particular murder in London, Ontario, should they not always be paired in discussions, as you're indicating, with, say, victims of jihad like the Charlie Hebdo cartoonist in France, or the teacher recently last year who showed a Charlie Hebdo cartoonist in his class and got beheaded? I mean, I guess a stance should be taken that any and all innocent people should be protected. No one should ever be attacked just for simply going about their lives and professing their beliefs, be it Islamic or secular or whatever.
Yeah, well, definitely that should be the case. But the agenda here is clear. It's the contrast also makes it very clear that when you have jihad attacks, you have elected officials in the United States and Canada and in Europe saying, we have to be sure to guard against a backlash against the Muslim community. We don't want to stigmatize anybody, and so on. If they were to behave the same way as the Canadian government is doing now, then whenever there was a jihad attack, you would see Justin Trudeau and his colleagues saying, we're going to crack down now on these Muslim Brotherhood-linked groups in Canada and wherever the attack may occur. And we're going to make sure that there's no preaching of anything that could incite to violence against non-Muslims on the part of Muslims. But they never say anything remotely like that. They say instead that we have to be careful not to be Islamophobic. And so it's one-sided. Actually, what it is whenever Muslims attack non-Muslims, Muslims are the victims. And whenever non-Muslims attack Muslims, Muslims are the victims. Muslims are the victims in both cases, in every case.
Yeah, that's interesting. There's never a parallel call for any sort of crackdown on ideology, on motivation. That brings up an interesting point in conjunction with this case recently in Canada. There's precisely an individual I came across an article written before this attack by sort of Canadian progressive Muslim. He's, among others, the founder of this group called Muslims Against Anti-Semitism, and I guess he's affiliated with people like Tariq Fatah in Canada. He wrote actually an article for the Huffington Post, if you can believe it, you know, this left-leaning publication, where he talked about influential Islamic groups in Canada, like the Islamic Society of North America, or the Islamic Circle of North America, or the NCCM, this National Council of Canadian Muslims. He wrote that they don't distance themselves from the ideology of Muslim Brotherhood and Jamaat-e-Islami, the South Asian Muslim Brotherhood affiliate. And then he writes, there's a dire need of an open discussion amongst journalists, Islamic centers, politicians, and law enforcement agencies on issues of jihadi mindset in Canada. So it's interesting that, you know, that politicians are never following up on this particular analysis that we need to look at jihadist ideologies.
Right, and it's wild how that all happened. I was there for the whole thing, and it was just remarkable to see it unfold, how right after 9/11, CARE and the other Muslim Brotherhood-linked groups in the United States insisted that the 9/11 hijackers were twisting and hijacking Islam as much as they had hijacked the airplanes, that they were not representative of true Islam, that Islam doesn't teach the things that they were doing, and that all Muslims condemned what they had done, and so on. And it was on that basis that the U.S. government ultimately ruled out any study of Islam in order to understand the terrorists. And I think that's crazy, because whether even if they are getting Islam all wrong, they're still working on the basis of their understanding of Islam. And so to rule out study of even their understanding of Islam in order to understand, you have to know the enemy, you know, that's the oldest adage of warfare. And so in order to know the enemy, you have to understand what they think, what they believe, what they value, and so on. And yet the United States government is voluntarily giving up doing that for fear of offending Muslims. And it's just astonishing. And it was done on the basis of this sleight of hand that is working from the same kind of claims of Islamophobia that we're seeing now in connection with this attack in Canada.
Well, looking at this whole discussion of Islamophobia and the sort of curtailing of critical inquiry into Islam, what is the state of that free speech and such inquiry into Islam in Canada? Here, for example, the discussion of this issue has come up in the context of this attack that in 2017, the Canadian Parliament had passed its M103 resolution against Islamophobia. What has happened since then in Canada?
Since then, the Canadian government has taken various steps to implement Resolution M103, which is against Islamophobia. Same kind of incoherence that I mentioned before, that it is against Islamophobia, which probably people think refers to attacks against innocent Muslims, but it does not clarify what Islamophobia is all about. And so it can be and is being used in order to silence any kind of critical inquiry into the motivating ideology behind jihad terrorism. And that's what's happening in Canada. This effort is advancing as the anti-Islamophobia motion M103 has given rise to various initiatives with funding from the government of Canada that are designed to curb Islamophobia and actually end up curbing all criticism of Islam.
Yeah, I noticed there's an interesting piece at the CBC website, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, by an individual, I think, if I recall his name, David Winery. He wrote about this 2017 motion 103 against Islamophobia in the Canadian Parliament, and he noted that it was brought in for consideration, and that 86 conservative members of the Conservative Party in Canada, including the current party leader Aaron O'Toole, voted against this motion. And yet recently, in response to this London, Ontario killing of these four members of this family, or O'Toole described this act as an Islamophobic act of terror. And then he also used the word Islamophobia again in his remarks to the House of Commons, the Canadian House of Commons, the next day. So it seems like, you know, this idea, this notion, this narrative of Islamophobia sort of spreading and going unchallenged even among conservatives now.
Yeah, and this is a big problem. This is, of course, the way conservatives always act in Canada, in the U.S. as well. They just go along with the left's agenda, and they might put up a few quibbles, but they don't question the basic premises. And this is a particular example of how they should be questioning the whole basis of the inquiry and talking about the freedom of speech, talking about the need to be able to speak critically even about religious ideas, and particularly about Islamic ideas, particularly when at a time when these ideas are being used by jihad terrorists to justify violence against people all over the world. If we can't talk about it, then that violence is not going to be challenged in any way or resisted in any way. And this is the kind of thing that the conservatives in Canada, Republicans in the United States ought to be saying, instead of just buying into this whole propaganda notion. Nobody had ever even heard of Islamophobia until a few years ago. There was a Muslim Brotherhood operative himself who broke with the organization, and he recounted that he was present when the term was formulated and that it was designed to silence critics of Islam and to bring Sharia blasphemy laws restricting criticism of Islam into the Western world. And conservatives are just going along with that instead of standing up and resisting it.
Yeah, that was an interesting individual who was at the International Institute of Islamic Thought, the IIIT, and he noted at the time that Muslims had looked to model this idea of Islamophobia back in the 1990s, 97, I believe it was, he said the year when a meeting took place and the strategy was agreed upon, that they were actually looking to model it, Islamophobia, on the concept of homophobia, which similarly has become sort of a widespread term that's sort of just widely accepted without criticism today. And there, again, a similar parallel that, you know, there's this conflation of any attacks on homosexual individuals was conflated with any criticisms of homosexual beliefs and behaviors, lifestyles and so forth. I guess now we're seeing that where, you know, you're just having children's cartoon characters and media and so forth being saturated, corporations with cereal boxes and so forth from Kellogg's and other corporations are just saturated with pro-LGBT imagery, advocacy. And there's a similar pattern there that the conflation of violence against individuals is made with any criticism of ideas, of beliefs and behaviors. Well, looking at this Islamophobia idea, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau then recently announced that in the wake of this attack in London, Ontario, that he's going to combat far-right groups, or we need to crack down on far-right groups. What far-right groups has the Canadian government been fighting?
Well, they did call the Proud Boys a terrorist organization, which is just incredibly short-sighted political pandering. Proud Boys is a group that was going to fight back for Western civilization, never sponsored any terrorist attacks, never supported any terrorist attacks, not a white supremacist group. Their leader it was Hispanic. The whole thing was based on false pretenses. But nonetheless, they needed as I discussed before, the Canadian government wanted to prop up its narrative that it shares with the American government, that it had to fight against right-wing terrorism and so on. And so you need some right-wing terrorists. And so they chose to scapegoat the Proud Boys in this way. And it's an indication of how their narrative doesn't really fit the facts, that the organization that they have designated as a terror group is quite obviously not really anything of the kind.
Yeah, the Proud Boys, I mean, I guess, you know, I'm not the biggest expert on the Proud Boys, but I mean, certainly I don't know of any incident where the Proud Boys say have killed anyone. I mean, as far as I know, they're kind of, I mean, they start out, you know, with Gavin McGinnis, and you know, I'm not sure they even know what they believe, but they, you know, they've presented themselves as being this kind of, you know, pro-Western civilization group, anti-leftist group, and, you know, have been involved in, like, going to rallies and stuff wherever, like, Antifa would show up and they would, you know, act as sort of like a bodyguard force or be ready to take on Antifa. And their current leader is this black Cuban-American guy. So it's, you know, not necessarily a white supremacist group. I mean, what does that mean? That what has happened to the Proud Boys in Canada? Are members of the group banned in Canada now, or...?
Yeah, it's a terrorist organization in Canada, so they disbanded. Obviously, if they continued any kind of activities as the Proud Boys, they would be subject to arrests, prosecution, who knows what. And any of the individuals who were in it in Canada can be virtually certain, 100% certain, that they are being very closely watched by the Canadian government at this point. And so here again, we have resources that are being used to chase fantasy and political narratives that could be devoted to dealing with actual threats.
Yeah, well, how about for you and anyone else you might know? You know, of course, you know, infamously, you had the case years ago, I guess in 2008 or so. You know, when you and Pamela Geller tried to go to the United Kingdom to give a talk after the killing of the drummer Rigby, the British soldier grenadier, in London, on the streets of London, by a Nigerian, Briton, jihadist, Muslim, and you were banned from entry when you arrived there and forced to turn back. Has any similar have there been any similar hindrances to anyone going into Canada recently from anyone you know?
Well, I know that I myself was not prevented from going into Canada, but I did go in a few years back. I was set to speak in Toronto. I arrived at the Toronto airport and was taken aside by security, questioned, held for 3 hours, and then released without any explanation. And I was allowed to give the talk. I'm sure that they had agents present at the talk and probably would have moved to arrest me or deport me or something if they had found anything that they could call Islamophobic in it. But I don't really match the caricature of me that is in the media, so they didn't find anything. But this is an example of what we're talking about, actually, that they don't have any people on the right. There isn't really a huge right-wing threat or a white supremacist threat and all that. And so what they did in Britain was they had to placate Islamic groups that were complaining that all their counterterror measures were directed against Muslims. Now, of course, their counterterror measures were directed against Muslims because Muslims were responsible for the primary terrorist threat. But in order to placate them and to appease the Muslim communities in Britain, which are, of course, growing very rapidly, the British government tried to create and is still trying to create an equivalent threat to the jihadis on the right. And so they claim that there is a right-wing threat or a white supremacist threat that is equivalent to or even greater than the jihad threat. And we have, of course, the American government saying there's a white supremacist threat that's the greatest threat of terrorism in the United States today. The only thing they lack in both Britain and the United States is actual white supremacists. Pamela Geller and I are not, and we don't condone any violence, don't approve of any violence, don't call for any violence. Never committed a crime, and so on. And so they just had to scapegoat us and other people who have been banned from Britain because they're trying to create an equivalent. And since they don't have equivalent people on the right, they just press into service in that way whoever they can find. And this was revealed really in a very direct way by the former Prime Minister, Theresa May, a few years back, 2017, I believe it was. She was boasting in the House of Commons in a speech about how she had banned Abu Qatada and Abu Hamza from Britain, as well as Robert Spencer and Pamela Geller, as if we were just the flip side of the coin of Abu Hamza and Abu Qatada, who were both called for the killing of people, who have approved of the killing of people, who were plotting terrorist activities in Britain. And it's kind of ludicrous to use us as the equivalents of such people. And there's nothing factual that bears that out, but we were just needed to shore up her narrative, just like Nathaniel Feltman in Canada is now needed to shore up the Islamophobia narrative, whatever the facts of the case may be.
Well, now in Canada, I mean, you talk about your experience. That's interesting that being questioned for 3 hours and then you're certain that there are probably some agents there watching you speak in Toronto, Canada. And indeed, we should note that, you know, Canada has, unlike the United States, you know, Canada and other Western countries have some pretty, have all these hate speech laws. I mean, Canada is known for all these human rights commissions that can, you know, fine people and even the standards there that are not the same as in a regular court for defense. So, you know, somewhere like you can get into real trouble, according to what you say up there in Toronto. Has Canada, do you know of any equivalent monitoring of, say, pro-jihadist people going into Canada? I mean, I've heard of, say, Canada, the Canadian government shutting down, say, various charities, say, associated for jihadist terrorism financing, like, I guess, various branches of, I'm trying to think if they've shut down, like, a branch of Islamic Relief or so. I mean, they shut down various sort of entities like that, but what it is like the flow of anyone who would have sort of jihadist sympathies like going into Canada?
I have not heard of any. I don't know for sure, but I haven't heard of anybody being restricted from entering Canada because of suspicion of ties to jihad groups or something of that kind. I keep a running list of jihadis who are admitted into Britain, which happens on a pretty frequent basis, jihadis and jihad preachers, jihad sympathizers, people with ties to jihad groups, they never have any trouble getting into Britain. And then meanwhile, there's an increasing list. It's not just Pamela and me, but many, many people who have been banned from Britain for the crime of opposing jihad violence. And so it's very clear what Britain is choosing for its future. And I suspect that Canada is much the same. Never come across, and I do track these kinds of things at Jihad Watch every day, never can come across, as I recall anyway, any instance of somebody being barred from Canada because he was connected with a jihad group.
Yeah, I guess it'd be interesting to ask in this respect the fellow Jihad Watch contributor, Christine Douglas-Williams, who herself is Canadian, you know, what specific knowledge she would have of what has occurred in Canada.
She would probably almost certainly know better than I would about the specifics.
But, of course, yeah, you have the specific case study, your own personal experience with the United Kingdom, and so you can monitor that. And, indeed, that's a very disturbing statement by Prime Minister Theresa May in the United Kingdom that she's comparing you with these promoters of jihad. Well, talking about these various violent threats, we've indicated here, there's this discussion about white supremacist assaults and so forth, crimes against Muslims. Are they really a greater threat than jihadist attacks? I mean, what sort of statistical basis would show that? I mean, in Canada now, for example, they're talking about this particular attack, and then a lot of people are making reference to the January 29th, 2017 Montreal mosque massacre. A shooter went in and killed, I believe it was, 6 people in a mosque. I mean, what sort of statistics are there in Canada or for the United States about jihadist violence versus any sort of white supremacist, white nationalist violence or violence against Muslims?
Well, the Montreal attack, just like this new attack, they were both heinous crimes. There's no doubt about that. But that's pretty much it. You can't list another, whereas there are 30-some thousand jihad attacks around the world since 9/11 and numerous other plots that were foiled before they came to violence. And so the idea that these two threats are equivalent is just not borne out by the facts. There are studies that purport to show that white supremacists are a bigger threat in the United States than jihadis, and they go by body count, and they say X number of people have been killed by white supremacists and X number of people have been killed by jihadis. What's interesting about it is that usually these studies start on September 12, 2001, and I think what an interesting date to choose to start your study. Why didn't you go back one more day, and then your numbers would look very different? And also, they don't take into account the fact that there are jihadis all over the world, and there are not white supremacists all over the world, even if there might not even be any in the United States or any significant number of them. And also, they don't take into account the foiled plot. And so the studies are obviously designed to manipulate people and make them think something that's not actually the case. They are not honest in analyses of the facts. Also, it's interesting, Andrew, I was reading recently a story about one of these government officials, Christopher Wray, the FBI director, or somebody was saying that white supremacists are the biggest threat in the United States, the biggest terrorism threat today. And the article started talking about Tim McVeigh, who set off a bomb in Oklahoma City in 1985, was it?
96.
96?
Yeah,
okay, well, that's still 25
years ago.
Or 95,
rather. 95, 95. Yeah, it was April,
okay.
April
so
19th.
25
like
years
the,
ago.
Yeah.
And we're talking, we don't have any newer examples? It shows the ridiculousness of this analysis that they have to go back 25 years to find any major attack, whereas I can give you so many jihad attacks around the United States over the last few years that a lot of people don't know about. I mentioned Fort Hood before. There was the Boston Marathon, San Bernardino, Chattanooga. Probably a lot of people don't know about that. A Muslim killed four people there in the name of Allah and Islam. There are so many, and yet we're told that this threat, of for which there are virtually no examples, is a greater threat than this other threat for which there are innumerable examples.
Well, I guess, yeah, I've always thought about that. I mean, one, you mentioned, there's just a greater law enforcement and military response committed to dealing with this global jihad phenomenon. So, you know, a person like this guy in Canada, no one's really paying attention. You know, some guy in Canada, some loner or something, you know, he can just, you know, any individual like that can, you know, take their truck and just drive over some people. Whereas, you know, law enforcement is heavily monitoring any of these terror networks around the world. And jihadism is, of course, a global phenomenon. And I think in particular, if you read the reports on terrorism from Europol for these last couple of years, you can go to their Europol online and read their annual terrorism reports. And clearly reading those reports, the bulk of the report is devoted to jihadist threats, openly identified in the Europol reports as jihadists. I mean, the largest number of arrests they make are affiliated with jihadist threats, or, you know, the greatest number of people are killed are by jihadists. And there you can make the argument that, you know, Europe has a much larger Muslim immigrant population than, say, Canada or the United States. You know, it's this old law of numbers that people make, point out that as the numbers of Muslims increase, you know, percentage-wise, then the number of problematical issues increase. I mean, after all, people have said that the greatest number of victims from such jihadist terrorist groups are precisely in Muslim-majority countries, right? I mean, the Middle East, you know, Iraq or Afghanistan and so forth, right there in the midst of all of this fighting with groups like the Taliban. But then I guess the second largest concentration of jihadist attacks would be in Europe with its Muslim migrant population. And then, you know, the United States and Canada only come in after that precisely because we have a much smaller population to draw upon for any such jihadist ideology. So it's important to recognize this issue in a global scale and also across the timeline. You know, say Timothy McVeigh in 1995, and then individuals like the Feltman now in London, Ontario, or the Christchurch shooting in New Zealand. You know, that's a much rarer occurrence than what we're seeing day in and day out with jihadist threats.
Yes, but you're speaking rationally, and we are not being ruled by rational people. We're being ruled by people who are fundamentally dishonest and want to either they are deeply deluded themselves, or I think more likely they want very much to delude and deceive the American people.
Yeah, and in this context, you know, it's interesting that this family that suffered this horrific loss was indeed from Pakistan, a Pakistani immigrant family in London, Ontario. And Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan then tweeted out that he condemned this attack in London, Ontario, and condemned it as part of a growing Islamophobia around the world. But, you know, you think about Pakistan, I mean, this is this country with this deadly blasphemy law that has the death penalty for blasphemy against Islam, and where although no one has been officially executed for blasphemy in Pakistan, you know, there have been all sorts of vigilante murders of individuals for accusations of blasphemy. People have been put on trial, and, you know, Pakistan as well is also a source of indeed state-sponsored terrorism, of giving support to groups like the Taliban and Lashkar-e-Taiba, which did the 2009 or 2008 attack, rather, in November 26, 2008 in Mumbai, against the train station and the hotels there and so forth, killing a couple hundred people there. I mean, should people be aware of just how sort of duplicitous this is? You talk about deceit. I mean, here we've got a guy, Imran Khan, who sort of put himself in the victim role, condemning Islamophobia, but you know, how credible is such a person who leads this Islamic Republic of Pakistan to talk about violence against innocents?
Oh, no, Pakistan is a wasteland of violence against innocents. It's astonishing. The kinds of things that I report out of Pakistan every day, people don't know how bad it is there. For example, just before we started our discussion here today, Andrew, I was working on a post for Jihad Watch about a Muslim mob in Pakistan. 300 people went into a Christian village, started ransacking the place because a young Christian spilled water on a Muslim. And they were enraged because Christians are unclean, according to the Quran in chapter 9, verse 28. And so the mob forms and the Christians are once again victimized. This is pretty much routine in Pakistan, and governing authorities and police look the other way because they are essentially sympathetic to the attackers.
Yeah, I mean, that brings up an issue of thinking of innocence. You know, do such Christians killed by jihadists around the world, or for that matter, we look at recently in the context of this renewed aggression by Hamas from the Gaza Strip against Israel during this Israel's campaign, Operation Guardian of the Walls, and you had all sorts of outbreaks of anti-Semitism here in the United States and around the world in Europe. I mean, precisely in Los Angeles, there you had a vehicle attack, a Muslim driving a car at a Jewish person while screaming Allahu Akbar in Los Angeles. I mean, do these people receive the same attention? I mean, in this particular case, on London, Ontario, there's been various online social media fund campaigns, like a GoFundMe campaign to raise money for the family that suffered this horrific crime. Something like $2 million and counting has been donated to the surviving members of this London, Ontario Muslim family. Has there ever been any similar response to victims of jihadist violence?
Oh, no. I've never seen anything like that. And as a matter of fact, I've seen numerous stories. There are numerous instances in Britain of jihad attackers getting legal aid, taxpayer-funded money for lawyers, while people like Tommy Robinson, who have stood against jihad violence in a very visible way in Britain, are arrested on various pretenses and are denied legal aid. And so it's really appalling that the victims of jihad attacks, they don't get any kind of special consideration at all, and are sometimes even having to witness the attackers being favored by the police, by the government, by authorities after the attack.
Well, does such sympathy for these victims in London, Ontario, I mean, does that refute the narrative of widespread Islamophobia? I mean, it seems like maybe you might want to say that, you know, there's a suspicion here that maybe even people are kind of sort of virtue signaling. I mean, there's, you know, people really want to take a bold stand here against such a horrific act. And, you know, people want to stand up, you know, I'm going to contribute money. I'm going to say, look, this, you know, I'm against this evil. What sort of Islamophobia is then there if you're seeing such widespread condemnation of this attack?
Yeah, it is, I think, definitely virtue signaling. People are attuned to the idea nowadays that, like I said before, Muslims are the unique victims of harassment and discrimination in the West. It isn't true, borne out by hate crime statistics, but it is a very common assumption. And so people are lining up to help this family to show that they're not part of the prevailing Islamophobia. They're going to fight against it and show that they are committed to us all marching together into the glorious multicultural future. The idea that the solicitude here is entirely one-sided never seems to enter into the picture.
I guess, yeah, that brings up issues that precisely today in memory of these victims and of this crime, there's now going to be a multi-faith march to end hatred in London, Ontario. Have any sort of jihadist attacks on non-Muslims ever provoked any such, you know, interfaith coming together, such interfaith solidarity?
Well, you know, after the Charlie Hebdo massacre of the cartoonist to Drew Muhammad, there was all that J. Swee Charlie business. And after Samuel Paty, the school teacher in France, was murdered for showing a cartoon of Muhammad in his class, there was a lot of the J. Swee professor or whatever it is. And that's all great, but it was never a march against hate. Nobody ever considers jihad violence to be hate. As a matter of fact, it's generally just ignored altogether. It's not something that has to be opposed. The attacks are deplored, and the victims are sometimes stood with, sometimes ignored. But when the victims are the focus of solidarity marches and so on, it's with a studied refusal to face the ideology of the people who attacked them. And there's never any discussion of why exactly this happened or how it came about, what the people who did it believe and what we can do about it to prevent it from happening again. That's never there.
Yeah, I guess, you know, speaking of looking at what to prevent such attacks and ideologies in conjunction with these memorial events, there's going to be a Canadian nationwide virtual dua, that is the Arabic dua, the word for prayer, virtual prayer across the nation. And among the speakers in this online event are going to be the Ijaz Tahir, who is the president of the Islamic Circle of North America, Canada affiliate. Now, this Islamic Circle of North America has been noted by many is sort of an offshoot or a North American based organization from this Jamaat-e-Islami South Asian Muslim Brotherhood organization. I mean, many members of ICNA have been linked to atrocities against Bangladeshis, Bengalis in Bangladesh during its 1971 independence war from Pakistan, where you had all sorts of crimes against humanity, mass rapes by the Pakistani army, and jihadist death squads killing Bangladeshi intellectuals. I mean, you know, should people be aware at these events for any sort of sympathy for such victims of just who they're dealing with? And maybe a question, I mean, should we be promoting any such organizations in any kind of multi-faith march to end hatred or virtual dua in Canada?
Well, this is all just virtue signaling, as you noted. It's all just – it doesn't do a thing. It just is a way for the people who participate in these exercises to show how virtuous they are, how great they are, how wonderful they are. It doesn't stop attacks. I mean, even the you know, if you're focused on so-called right-wing attacks. There aren't any right-wing violent going to say, oh, they marched against hate, I better stop. And neither jihadis aren't going to do that either. It's just ridiculous. It's like the condemnations that you see. After jihad attacks, there generally tend to be government officials lining up to say, I condemn this attack. And I think, was this ever really in doubt? Do you really think people think you're for it? They're just trying to show that they are good people who are on top of the situation. It's really meaningless.
Yeah, I find it interesting. I guess one thing that sort of piqued my curiosity in these media reports is that one of the victims, the man, Salman Afzal, he was a physiotherapist, worked at various homes for the elderly, and was apparently much beloved, and worked at, for example, Ritz Lutheran Villa, a home for the elderly nearby. And it was noted in one media report that he was really a devout Muslim, and he prayed five times daily and had no aggression at all in the world. He was polite and kind, a London resident said of him, some person who knew him. You know, it struck me, we have this reference to piety of a kind man, a clearly beloved, nice man. Do you ever see any similar reference to piety when someone engages in a jihadist attack?
Well, no, then you usually find it's funny because usually in jihad attacks, they interview the family of the attacker, and the family of the attacker quite often says that, yes, he was very religious, or he wasn't religious, and then he got religious over the last few weeks or months. And it's interesting to note that then in stories of that kind, generally what follows is somebody from the local mosque saying, we never knew him, we never saw him, he had nothing to do with us, what he's done here has nothing to do with Islam, and so on. Whereas any other kind of attacks, you know, you're not going to find anybody. I mean, of course, they don't have enough real white supremacists to do this anyway, but in none of the stories about Nathaniel Veltman did anybody say, well, you know, we're white supremacists, but we're not violent, or something like that. Nobody wanted to exonerate that community, but that's always job one when it comes to jihad attacks in regard to the Muslim community.
Well, for our listeners out there, you've been listening to Robert Spencer, the director of Jihad Watch, and we've been discussing the recent London, Ontario attack on a Muslim family, which killed four, with Robert here. And so we hope you'll tune in next on Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Harrod. And we'll hope you'll join in next Friday to listen to another episode where we'll discuss important issues of the day for conservatives and others. Well, Robert Spencer, thank you for joining the show.
Pleasure, Andrew. Thank you.
Goodbye.